Obviously, I'm trying not to think grandiose things like, you will remember this day for the rest of your life. In the end, I just wear what I always wear. My brown pants, that won't chafe, and my chunky dark green sweater that Mum's mother knitted for her. I like to think of Mum wearing it. It gives the sweater history. I look into my spotted mirror and make a fierce face under my freckles. My eyebrows straight across over my blue eyes. I look messy and cross. I pull some of my hair out of my ponytail across my forehead, trying to look like someone other than the girl I grew up being. Someone people won't laugh at when they see me arrive on the beach. It doesn't work. I have too many freckles. I draw my hair back into the ponytail again. In the kitchen, Finn is already up, and he is standing at the sink. He is wearing the same sweater as yesterday, and he looks like a man who has shrunk in the night while his clothing pooled around him. Something smells sort of brittle and carbon-like, almost good, like steak or toast, until I realize that it's actually a bad smell, like burned paper and hair. "Gabe awake?" I ask. I peer uncertainly into the cupboard to avoid having to look at Finn. I'm not sure I want to talk. Looking in the cupboard, I'm not sure I want to eat either.
"He's already gone to the hotel," Finn says.
"I... here." And with this, he sets a mug with a spoon standing in it down on the table. It's got stains of whatever's in it on the sides in such a way that I just know it's going to leave a ring on the table. But it's steaming, and I suspect that it's hot chocolate. "You made this?" Finn looks at me.
"No. St. Anthony brought it to me in the night. He was very put out I didn't give it to you right then."
He turns back around. I'm shocked, both by the reappearance of Finn's humour and the gift of the hot chocolate. I see now that the counter is an absolute mess of pots, but Finn used to distill a single cup of cocoa. And I'm certain now that the odour hanging on the air is a smell of milk spilt on the hot burner. But it doesn't matter in the face of his intention. It sort of makes my lower lip not quite sure of itself, but I clamp my teeth on it for a moment until everything's steady. By the time Finn sits down on the other side of the table with a mug of his own, I'm normal again. "Thanks," I say, and Finn looks uncomfortable. Mum used to say he was like a fairy. He didn't like to be thanked. I add, "Sorry."
"I put salt in it,"
Finn tells me, as if this eliminates a need to be grateful. I try it. It's good. If there's salt in it, I can't taste it around the floating islands of partially stirred cocoa. They dissolve in my mouth in not unpleasant lumps of powder. I can't remember if Finn has ever made cocoa before. I think he only ever watched me. "I can't tell there's salt in it."
"Salt," Finn says, "makes cocoa sweeter."
I think this is a pretty stupid thing to say, because how could something not sweet make something sweeter? But I let it pass. I stir my cocoa and mash a few of the lumps of cocoa against the side of the mug with the back of the spoon. Finn knows I don't believe him, though, and says,
"Go and ask at Paulson's, then. I watched them make the chocolate muffins with salt."
"I didn't say I didn't believe you. I didn't say anything at all." He mashes a spoon in his own cup.
"I know you didn't."
He doesn't ask me how long I'll be gone today, or I'm going to get a horse to ride, or anything about Gabe. I can't decide if I'm glad not to talk about it, or if it's driving me crazy that he's not. We just slurp down the rest of our drinks, and when I get up to put my mug in the sink, I finally say,
"I guess I'll be gone most of the day."
Finn gets up and puts his mug next to mine. He looks very serious, his neck skinny and turtle-like poking out of the oversized sweater. He points to the counter behind me. Among the wreck of pots and dishes is a cut-up apple, with a bit of crumbs from the counter stuck to one of the cut edges.
"That's for Dove. I want to come with you today."
"You can't come with me," I say, without even stopping to think about how his words make me feel.
"Not every day," Finn says. "Just today. Just the first day."
I battle momentarily with the image of myself emerging on the beach, proud and lonesome, versus the reality of arriving with one of my brothers to watch from the sidelines and see how it's done. Okay, that would be good. Finn gets his hat. I get my hat. I knitted both of them myself, and mine is patterned in white and two different shades of brown. Finn's is red and white. They're lumpy, but they fit. In our hats, we stand among the wreckage of the kitchen. For a moment, I see the room like anyone else might see it. It looks like everything around Finn has crawled out of the mouth of the kitchen sink drain. It's a mess, and we're a mess. And no wonder Gabe wants to leave. Let's go, I say.
Chapter 6. Sean. That first day, Gory has me come down to the beach before anyone else to try a piebald mare he has dredged from the ocean some indeterminate time before. He's so certain that I will want her for Malvern that he's priced her high enough for two horses. Under the dark blue early morning sky, the tide just starting to pull back from the sand, my fingers frozen where they poke from my fingerless gloves, I watch him trot her back and forth for me. Her hoofprints are the first on the beach. The tide has wiped the sand clean, removing all traces of Mutt's botched efforts the night before. She's striking. Water horses come in every color that normal land horses do, but, like land horses, most are bay or chestnut. Less often dun or palomino or black or gray. It's very rare to find a piebald water horse, equally black and white. Sharp white clouds across a black field, but flashy color doesn't win races. The piebald mare doesn't move terribly. She has a good shoulder. Lots of Kapil Ishka have good shoulders. Unimpressed, I watch black cormorants spin through the sky above us, their silhouettes like small dragons. Gory brings the mare to me. I hitch myself onto her back and look down at Gory.
"She's the fastest Kapil Ishka you'll ever sit on," he says in his grainy voice.
Kor is the fastest Kapil Ishka I've ever sat on. Beneath me, the piebald mare smells like copper and rotting seaweed. Her eye, turned toward me, weeps seawater. I don't like the feel of her, sinuous and hard to hold. But then I am used to Kor.
"Take her out," Gory says. "Tell me you can find anything faster."
I let her trot. She minces through the packed sand toward the water, ears pinned to her mane. I thumb my iron pieces out from my sleeves and track them counterclockwise on her withers, right on a heart-shaped spot of white. She shudders and twists her body away from my touch. I don't like the unhorse-like tilt to her head, or the way that she never unpins her ears. None of the horses are to be trusted, but I trust her less than most. Gory urges me to gallop her, feel her speed for myself. I doubt that there is anything she can do at a gallop to convince me that what she is like at a trot is worth it, but I let out her reins and nudge her sides. She is down the beach like an osprey diving for a fish, breathlessly fast, and always, always conscious of the water, angling toward the sea, and again that sinuous, slippery movement. She seems far less horse than sea creature to me, even now, even in the deep of October, even on dry land, even with me whispering in her ear. But she is fast. Her strides eat the sand, and we pass by the cove that marks the end of the good surface in only seconds. The rush of speed bursts through me, like bubbles popping on the surface of water. I don't want to think of her as faster than Kor, but she must be close. Anyway, how can I know without him there? It's beginning to get rocky. When I move to slow her, the piebald courses upward in a rear, her teeth snapping, predatory. All of a sudden she smells overwhelmingly of the sea, not of the beach, which is what most people think is the odor of the sea. Not of seaweed or of salt, but of your head beneath the surface, breathing water, lungs full of the ocean. The iron has no effect as we pelt toward the water. My fingers work through her mane, tying knots in threes and sevens. I sing in her ear, and all the while my inside hand turns her in smaller and smaller circles, each one away from the water. Nothing is sure. As we charge across the sand, the magic in her calls to me, insidious. Precious little of my bare skin touches her. A wrist against her neck, perhaps, though my leg is guarded inside my boots. But still, a pulse hums through me, lulling me to trust, compelling me to join her in the sea. It's only a decade of riding dozens of the water horses that allows me to remember myself. And only barely. Everything in me says to abandon the struggle, fly with her into the water. Threes, sevens, iron across my palm. I whisper,
"You will not be the one to drown me."
It feels like minutes to slow her, to bring her back toward Gory, but it's probably only seconds. And all the while her neck still feels snaky to me, and her teeth are still bared in a way that no land horse would present them. She's trembling beneath me. It's hard to forget how swift she was.
"Didn't I tell you she was the fastest thing you'd ever ride?"
Gory asks. I slide off her and hand him the reins. He takes them with a puzzled expression on his already puzzling face. I say, "This mare is going to kill someone."
"Hey, now,"
Gory objects. Then,
"They've all killed someone."
"I want no part of her," I say, even though part of me does.
"Someone else will buy her," Gory says, "and then you will be sorry."
"That someone else will be dead," I reply. "Throw her back." I turn away. Behind me, I hear Gory say,
"She's faster than your red stallion."
"Throw her back," I repeat, not turning around. I know he won't.
Chapter 7. Puck. I didn't reckon that it would be awful, but the whole island is crammed onto the beach, it feels like. Finn convinced us to take the Morris, which promptly broke down. So we arrived after just about everybody else. In front of us, there are two seas, one far-off ocean of deep blue, and one seething mass of horses and men. All of them are men. Not a girl among them, unless you count Tommy Fork, because his lips are so pretty. The men are 1,000 times louder than the ocean. I don't see how they can train or move or breathe. They're all shouting at the horses and at each other. It's like a big argument, but I can't tell who's mad at who. Finn and I both hesitate on the long sloped path down to the beach. The ground beneath our feet is uneven, with divots from horses that have been led down already. Finn frowns as he looks at the collection of people and animals. But my eye is caught instead by a horse galloping at the faraway edge of the sucked-out tide. It is bright red, like fresh blood, with a small, dark figure crouched low on its back. Every few strides, the horse's hooves hit the very edge of the surf, and water sprays up. The sight of the horse galloping, stretched out breathlessly fast, is so beautiful that my eyes prickle.
"That one looks like two horses stuck together," Finn says.
His observation pulls my gaze away from the red horse and closer to the cliffs. "That's a piebald," I tell him. The mare he's gesturing to is snowy white, splashed with big patches of black. Near her withers, she has a small black spot that looks like a bleeding heart. A tiny little gnome of a man in a bowler hat is leading her away from the others.
"That's a piebald," mimics Finn.
I smack him and look back to where the red horse and rider were, but they're gone. I feel strangely put out.
"I guess we should go down," I say. "Is everybody down there today?" Finn asks.
"Sure looks like it."
"How are you going to get a horse?"
Because I don't exactly have an answer, the question annoys me. I'm annoyed even more when I notice we're both standing in exactly the same position. So either I was standing like my brother, or he was standing like me. I take my hands out of my pockets and snap.
"Is this Riddle Day? Are you going to ask me questions all day?"
Finn makes his mouth and his eyebrows into parallel lines.
He's very good at this face, although I don't know exactly what it means.
When he was little, Mum called him a frog because of this face. Now that he sometimes has to shave, it doesn't look so much like an amphibian. Anyway, he makes the frog face and sidles off into the commotion. For a moment, I think about going after him, but I'm suddenly pasted to the ground by a shrill wail. It's the piebald mare. She's separated from the others, looking back either toward them or toward the sea. Her head's thrown back, but she's not whinnying. She's screaming. The keening cuts through the wind, the sound of the surf, the bustle of activity. It's the wail of an ancient predator. It's 1,000 miles away from any sound that a natural horse would make. And it's horrible. All I can think is this the last thing my parents heard? I'm going to lose my nerve if I don't get onto the beach right now. I know it. I can feel it. My limbs feel like seaweed. I'm so wobbly that I almost turn my ankle on one of the divots left by the hooves. I'm relieved when the piebald mare stops her crying, but I still can't ignore that the Kapil Ishka don't even smell like proper horses as I get closer to them. Dove smells soft, all hay and grass and molasses. The Kapil Ishka smell like salt and meat and waste and fish. I try to breathe through my mouth and not think about it. There are dogs careening around my legs, and nobody is looking where he's going. Horses are clawing at the air, and men are hawking insurance and protection to the riders. They are more riled up than terriers in a butcher shop. I'm glad that Finn stormed off, because the idea of him seeing me totally bewildered seems unbearable. The truth is, I have a very rough idea of how to go about securing a horse for the race without money up front. But it's mostly based on things that we used to talk about in school, when the boys would all boast that they were going to ride in the races when they grew up. They never really did. Mostly they just moved away to the mainland or became farmers. But their big plans were a good source of information, especially since my family was one of the few that didn't follow the races.
Go!
Snarls a man holding a roan horse that is pawing and charging, galloping without moving an inch.
Mind your damn feet!
I stare down at my feet. And it takes me a second too long to realize that there was a circle drawn in the sand, and my boots have scuffed a line through it. I jump out of the circle.
Don't bother,
shouts the man as I try to retrace the line of the circle. The roan tugs toward the break in the line. I back up and get shouted at again for my trouble. Two men are carrying an older boy away between them. He's bleeding from his head, and he swears at me. I whirl away and almost trip over a scruffy dog with sand in its fur.
Curse you!
I snap at the dog, just because it won't say anything back.
Puck Connolly!
It's Tommy Fork, with his pretty lips.
What are you doing down here?
At least, that's what I think he says. It's so loud that other people's conversations drown out most of his words, and the wind robs the rest.
I'm looking for bowler hats,
I say. Black bowler hats are supposed to mean dealers. On the rest of the island, someone wearing one is called a monger, after the horsemongers, and it's not the nicest of names. Sometimes the boys wear them if they want to be seen as rebels. Mostly, it just means they're pissers. Tommy shouts,
I didn't hear you right!
But I know he did. He just doesn't believe what he heard. Dad once said people's brains are hard of hearing. It doesn't matter if Tommy's stone-cold deaf on a plate, though, because I catch a glimpse of a bowler hat on the head of the little gnome man who had the piebald mare earlier.
Thanks,
I tell Tommy, though he hasn't really helped. I leave him behind and wind through the crowd toward the gnome. Up close, the man does not look quite so short, but he does look like his face has been hit solidly a few times with a brick, twice to really squish it, and once more for good measure. He's arguing with someone.
Sean Kendrick,
spits the monger, which is a name that sounds familiar for some reason, especially said in that disdainful note. The bowler-hatted gnome doesn't have a gnome-like voice at all. His voice is lined with cigarette smoke, and he puts gritty H's at the beginning of his words.
Ha! Is it half full of salt water? What's he saying about my horses now? I don't like to repeat it.
Replies the other figure politely. It's Dr. Horsell, with his shiny black hair parted neatly on the side. I like Dr. Horsell. He's very level-headed, and he's a very compact, tidy sort of person who reminds me of a drawing of a person instead of an actual person. I wanted to marry him when I was 6.
He's crazy, is he, Ocean? Says the bowler-hatted monger. Come now, if you back her, you'll want her.
All the same, Dr. Horsell says.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to pass. She's fast as the devil,
the gnome says, but the doctor is already retreating, and his back doesn't listen. Excuse me, I say, and my voice sounds very high to me. The gnome turns. His mismatched face is fearsome when matched with an irritable expression. I try to organize my thoughts into a respectable-sounding question.
Do you do fifths?
Fifths is another thing I learned about from the daydreaming boys. It's gambling, more or less. Sometimes a monger will let you have a horse for nothing on the condition that whatever you win in the race, they get 4/5 of it. That's not really anything, unless you come in first. Then you could buy the whole island if you wanted. Well, at least most of Skarmouth. Except for what Benjamin Mulvin owns. The gnome looks at me.
No,
he says. But I can tell what he really means is not for you. I feel a little shaky inside, because it hadn't occurred to me that they would say no. Were there that many people who would ride Capel Ishka that the mongers could be choosy? I hear myself say, okay, could you point me towards someone else who might? I add hurriedly, sir, because Dad once said that saying sir makes gentlemen out of ruffians. The gnome says,
bowler hats, ask them.
Some ruffians stay ruffians. When I was younger, I would have spit on his shoes, but Mum had broken me of the habit with the help of a small blue stool and a lot of soap. So I just leave without saying thanks. He was even less help than pretty Tommy Fork, and I wind my way through the crowd looking for the next bowler hat, only to get the same results. All of them say no to the ginger-haired girl.
They don't even consider it.
One frowns and one laughs and one doesn't even let me finish my sentence. By now it's lunchtime and my stomach is snarling at me. There are people hawking food to the riders, but it's expensive and everything smells like blood and bad fish. There's no sign of Finn. The tide is starting to creep in and some of the less brave souls have already left the beach. I retreat a bit and press my back against the chalk cliff, my hands spread out on the cold surface. Several feet above my head, the chalk is lighter, marking where the water will rise in a few hours. I imagine standing here until it does, salt water slowly swallowing me. Tears of frustration burn behind my eyes. The worst of it is that I'm sort of glad they all said no. These terrifying monsters are not at all like Dove, and I can't even start to imagine myself trying one out, much less taking it home and training it to eat expensive bloody meat instead of me. In the summer, children sometimes catch dragonflies and tie strings round them, just behind their eyes, and lead them like they are pets. Those dragonflies are what these grown men look like with the Capel Ishka. The horses drag them around like they have no weight whatsoever. What would they do to me? I look out across the sea. Close to the shore, the water is turquoise in places where white rocks have fallen from the cliffs into the water, and black where dark brown kelp covers the boulders. Somewhere across all these buckets of water are the cities we'll lose Gabe to. I know we'll never see him again. It won't matter that he's still alive somewhere. It'll be just as bad as Mum and Dad. Mum liked to say that some things happen for a reason, that sometimes obstacles were there to stop you from doing something stupid. She said this to me a lot. But when she said it to Gabe, Dad told him that sometimes it just means you need to try harder. I take a deep breath and head back toward the only bowler hat who doesn't avoid my eye, the gnome. He has only one horse in his hands now, the piebald mare that screamed earlier.
Hey, you!
He says this, as if I'm about to pass him by. I think we need to talk, I tell him. I feel I'm friendly and messy. Any charm I had when I started this is back at home, with the makings of a sandwich.
I was thinking the same thing. I'm about to be off. I'd rather not be back tomorrow. And you'd rather have a capel. What will you give me for her?
My first reaction is to think, well, how much do I have? And then I come to my senses and remember his unhelpfulness from earlier. Nothing up front, I say. I have to be firm on this. If Gabe really does leave us to fend for ourselves, we'll have nothing at the end either.
I'm just looking for a fifth. This mare is amazing, the gnome says. Fastest thing on land at the moment.
He stands back so I can see her, restless on the end of the lead, a chain wrapped over her nose and fed through her halter. She is drop-dead gorgeous, and absolutely giant. I feel I could stack dove on top of dove and only then be able to look the piebald in her wild eye. She stinks like a corpse, washed up after a storm. She eyes one of the loose dogs that darts around the beach. Something about her gaze is deeply unsettling.
Then you wouldn't mind taking a gamble on her, I say.
I feel petulant, but I try to sound businesslike. It's not the easiest thing in the world, trying to be treated like an adult during a negotiation when the idea of driving a successful bargain is making you a little sick to your stomach.
I'm not in the mood to come back and collect, the monger says.
I cross my arms. I pretend I'm Gabe. He has a way of looking both unimpressed and disinterested when he's really both of these things. I sound as bored as possible.
Either she's everything, you say, or she isn't. If she's the fastest thing on four legs, don't you trust her to win more than you could sell her for?
The gnome eyes me.
It's not her I don't trust.
I glower at him. I was just thinking the same thing. He grins suddenly.
Get up on her then, the monger says. Let's see what you got.
He jerks his head toward his saddle, tipped up on its pommel on the sand. I take a deep breath and try not to remember her scream from earlier. I try not to think about how my parents died. I need to think about Gabe and his face when he said that he was leaving. I feel like my hands are fluttering, but they're quite still at my sides. I can do this.
Chapter 8. Puck. The monger leads the mare up to one of the kelp-covered boulders for me to use as a mounting block. She fidgets, around and around, never quite close enough to it. She won't stop looking at the dog that's hovering around, interested in someone's rejected breakfast near her hooves. The wind is cold on my neck, and my toes are numb, little stones in my boots.
She's not getting any stiller than this, the monger says. Are you on or off?
My hands are balled into fists to keep them from betraying me. All I can think of is those massive teeth pulling my parents down into the ocean. It's not even fear that's stopping me right now. It's imagining them watching me from wherever they might be. Can they see this beach from heaven? Maybe the cliffs block the view. And thinking about what they would say. They'd always scoffed at the races, and the horses had killed them in their boat, and now here I was, going to get on one of them to ride in the races. I can just imagine Dad's face, and the way a small semicircle wrinkle appeared on his upper lip when he got disgusted or disappointed. The mare jerks her head up. The gnome is nearly lifted from his feet. There has to be another way. There has to be something I can do that will keep me off this horse. But how can I ride in the races without her? I realize then that Finn has appeared from nowhere to stand beside the boulder I'm balanced on. He doesn't say anything. His fingers are pinching his upper arms over and over again as he looks up at me, but he doesn't seem to notice them. Stop that, I tell him, and he stops. I think I've made up my mind.
Girlie! The monger says. Come on now!
The mare's muscles shudder beneath her skin. This isn't who I am. I say, I'm sorry, I've changed my mind. I just have time to see him roll his eyes when everything becomes a blur of motion. There is a surge of black and white, and a shove pushes me from the boulder. My breath gasps out in two massive puffs as my back slams the ground. Part of my face goes warm and wet. As the mare rears above me,
I realize that there is something screaming at the same time I realize that the wetness on my face is blood, coming from above, not from me, draining from the thing in the piebald mare's jaws. I roll out of the way of the hooves, scrubbing sand from my eyes, trying to straighten, trying to get my breath back, trying to see. The mare crouches, shaking her dark quarry. She's ripping it, holding part down with a hoof. The sand pools blood. I scream Finn's name. Now the mare tosses part of her victim at me, ears flattened back. I half gasp, half sob, jumping back from the bloody joint. There's something stringy coming out of it, like jellyfish tentacles. I want to just kneel down and stop thinking. The piece in front of me is covered with short, dark hair, matted with sand and blood. It's a ruin, almost unrecognizable. I am in danger of throwing up. It's the dog. People are shouting, "Sean Kendrick!" But I'm shouting, "Finn!" And there he is. He is a copy of the weird carvings on the church doorway in Skarmouth. Little old men with big, round eyeballs. He says, "I thought..." I know, because it's what I was thinking too. "Please don't ride her," Finn says, fervent. I can't quite remember the last time he's asked me something and sounded like he really meant it. "Don't ride one of them." "I'm not," I say. "I'm riding Dove."
Chapter 9. Sean. That evening, long after everyone is driven inland by the high tide, I bring Cor down to the beach. Our shadows are giants before us. This time of year it gets dark at 5 and the sand is already cooling. I leave my saddle and boots at the top of the boat ramp, where grass still grows through the soft sand. Cor's eyes are on the ocean as it slowly slides back toward low tide. We leave fresh prints in the hard-packed sand the tide's left behind. It is frigid against my bare feet, especially when cold seawater presses out of the ground around my skin. My blistered feet welcome it. End of the first day. The endless first day. The beach has had its share of casualties. One boy fell off and bloodied his forehead on a boulder. Another man got bitten, an impressive-looking wound, but nothing a pint and a few hours of sleep won't fix. And then there was the dog. I couldn't be surprised that its maiming was the piebald mare's handiwork. All in all, there have been worse starts to the training. This evening, the registration will start at Grattan's. I'll put my name and Cor's there, though at this point it feels like a formality. Then there will be a frantic week of uncertain islanders and tourists trying out horses to see if they have the nerve to truly race. And if they do, if they have the nerve to race on the horse they have beneath them. Horses will be bought, sold, bartered. Men become owners, fifths, riders. It's a frustrating time for me. Too much negotiation and not enough training. It's always a relief when the festival ends the first week and forces riders to officially declare their mounts. That's really when life begins. Cor lifts his head, ears pricked, neck curved, as if he's courting the Scorpio Sea. I whisper to him and tug his lead. It's me I want him paying attention to, not the song of this powerful water. I watch his eye, his ears, the line of his body, to see whose voice will be more potent tonight, mine or the ocean's. He jerks his head toward me so fast that I have an iron rod out of my pocket before he's finished his turn. But he wasn't attacking, merely moving to study me with his good eye. I trust Cor more than any of them. I should not trust him at all. His neck is soft, though the skin around his eyes is tight, so into the surf we go. I let my breath out in a rush as the cold water creeps up my ankles. And then we stand there, and I watch him again, seeing what effect the magic eddying around his ankles has. He shivers, but doesn't tense. We have done this before, and the month is young. I cup a handful of salt water and tip it onto his shoulder, my lips pressed against his skin, whispering. Still he stands. So I stand with him and let the gritty surf work on my tired feet. Kor, red as the sunset, looks out to the ocean. The shore faces east, and so he looks out tonight. Deep blue and then black, the sky and the water mirror images. Our shadows fall into the ocean, too, changing colors with the breakers and foam beneath them. When I look at Kor's shadow, I see an elegant giant. When I look to mine, for the first time, I see my father's shadow. Not quite my father's. My shoulders don't have his slight hunch, as if against perpetual cold, and his hair was longer, but it is there in the rigid posture, the chin always lifted, a horseman even on the ground. I am caught off guard, so when Kor moves up and away, I do nothing. He is in a half rear before I realize it, but then he brings both his hooves down in the exact same place they left, making a mighty wall of water spray my face. I stand there, salt in my mouth, and I see that his ears are pricked at me, neck arched. For the first time in days, I laugh. In response to the sound, Kor shakes his head and neck like a dog shedding water. I back up a few steps in the water and he follows me. And then I come after him and kick a splash at his body. He winces, looking deeply wounded, and then pause to splash me in return. Back and forth we go. I never have my back to him, as he follows me and I him. He pretends to drink the water and tosses his head in mock disgust. I pretend to drink a handful and throw it at him. Finally, I am out of breath and my feet are sore from the pebbles and the water is nearly too cold to bear. I go to Kor and he lowers his head, pressing his face against my chest. He is warm through my soaked shirt. I trace a letter on the skin behind his ears to still him, and I rub my fingers through his mane to still me. Not too far away, I hear a distant splash. It could be a fish, although it would have to be sizable for me to hear it over the breakers. I look out over the sea as it turns to black. I don't think it is a fish, and neither does Kor, who is again looking out toward the horizon. Now he trembles, and when I back out of the surf, it takes a long minute to convince him to follow. He takes one slow step, then another, until the water is no longer touching him, and then he stops, rigid, legged. He looks back to the sea, lifts his head, and curls back his lip. I snap the lead sharply and press the iron into Kor's chest before he can call. While he's in my hands, he won't sing their song. As I walk back up the gradual slope to the boat slip, I see silhouettes at the top of the road to Skarmouth. They are standing at the ridge where it meets the sky, black against purple. Though they're distant, one of them is the unmistakably graceless form of Mutt Malvern. Their posture is undeniably interested in my progress, so I'm wary as I make my way. It doesn't take me long to discover that Mutt Malvern has pissed in my boots. They're laughing now on the ridge. I won't give Mutt the satisfaction of my disgust. So I tip the boots out, this beach is too good for his urine, and tie their laces together. I let them hang on either side of the saddle on Kor's back and start up the slope. Though it's nearly dark, there's still a lot to get done. I have to be to Grattan's before 10. The day stretches out in front of me, invisible in the darkness. We climb inland. My boots smell of piss.
Chapter 10. Puck. It's been a long time since I've been in Skarmouth after dark, and it reminds me of the time that Dad cut his hair. For the first 7 years of my life, Dad had dark, curly hair that was like me, in that he told it first thing in the morning what he wanted it to do, and then it went and did pretty much whatever it wanted to do. Anyway, when I was 7, Dad came back from the docks with his hair close shaven. And when I saw him walk in the door and kiss my mother on the mouth, I started to cry, because I thought he was a stranger. And that's what Skarmouth has done after dark. It's turned into an entirely different Skarmouth from the one I've known my whole life, and I don't feel like letting it kiss me on the mouth any time soon.
Night has painted the entire town dark blue. All of the buildings press against each other and, clinging to the rocks, peer down into the endless black quay beneath them. Streetlights make brilliant halos. Paper lights crawl along wires tied to telephone poles. They look like Christmas lights or fireflies, spiralling up toward the faint dark outline of St. Columbus above the town. There is a legion of bicycles leaned against walls, and more cars than I knew existed on the entire island are parked along the streets, streetlights caught in their windshields. The cars have disgorged unfamiliar men, and the bicycles have bucked off half-familiar boys. I've only ever seen this many people in the streets on fair days. It's magical and terrifying. I feel lost, and I'm only in Skarmouth. I can't imagine Gabe making his way on the mainland.
"Pat Connolly!"
shouts a voice that I know belongs to Joseph Beringer.
"Isn't it past your bedtime?"
I park Finn's bicycle as close to the butcher's as I can get it, and lean it against the metal rail that is meant to keep you from falling into the quay unless you absolutely mean to. The water smells weird and fishy tonight, and I peer down to see if there are any fishermen's boats down there to account for the smell. There's nothing but black water and reflections, making it look like there is another Skarmouth submerged under the salt water. Joseph crows something else that I don't pay any mind to. In a way, I'm grateful that Joseph's here, being an oaf, because he's such a fixture of life here that he makes everything else seem more familiar. My head jerks as Joseph pulls my ponytail. I whirl around to face him, hands on my hips. He gives me his too big smile. He is pimply under his blonde hair. His mouth goes woo like he's impressed that I'm looking at him. I try to think of something catchy to say, but there's nothing but irritation that something that was funny to an 11-year-old boy is still funny to a 17-year-old one. So I just say ferociously,
"I don't have time for you tonight, Joseph Beringer."
This is true always, but truer tonight. I'm supposed to sign up as a race participant today, I think. Because of my hurry, Finn graciously offered to feed Dove for me. When I left, he was looking at a bucket, as if it was the most complicated invention he had ever seen. Beside me, Joseph is going on about my bedtime again. He likes to just take a topic and worry it to death, never a danger of missing anything subtle with him, and I simply ignore him as I hurry down the walk to Grattan's, the butcher shop. As I look at all the people, some of them tourists already, I think about how Mum used to say that we needed the races, that this would be a dead island without them. Well, the island's alive tonight. Grattan's is a riot of sound, with people spilling out onto the walk. I have to push my way through the door. I wouldn't say people in Skarmouth are rude as a rule, but beer makes people deaf. Inside, the place is abuzz with noise, and a crooked line leads around the halls. The ceiling feels low and crowded with its exposed timbers close overhead. I've never seen so many people in here before. In a terrible way, though, it makes sense that the butchers should be the unofficial centre for the races, on account of this is where all the riders get their meat from. Except me. I see Thomas Grattan straight away, shouting directly into someone's ear by the opposite wall. His wife, Peg, is behind the counter, smiling and chatting, a piece of chalk in her hand. Thomas may own the place, but Dad said that Peg ruled it. Every man in Skarmouth is in love with Peg. Dad said this was because they knew that Peg could cut their heart out neat, and they loved her for it. Certainly isn't for her looks. I heard Gabe say once that Mutt Mulvin had bigger tits than Peg, which I suppose is probably true, but I remember being very shocked at my brother saying something so crass and unfair, because what say does a girl have in how big her chest gets? I edge into the single line of people that leads to where Peg writes names up on the chalkboard. I am standing behind a man in a dull blue jacket and a hat, and his back is so high he blocks my view of everything. I feel like I've become a toddler in a room that dangles with meat hooks. Thomas Grattan roars to the crowd to stop smoking in the shop, and men roar laughingly back at him about Thomas not being able to stand any heat near his meat. I begin to feel uncertain, like I'm not sure I'm even supposed to be standing in the line. I think people are looking at me. I hear people at the counter placing bets. Maybe I'm wrong, and this has nothing to do with signing up for the races. Maybe they won't even let me sign up with Dove. The only positive thing is that I've lost Joseph Beringer in the process. I step to the side of the giant in front of me to read the chalkboard again. At the top it says, Jockeys, and then to its right, Capel. Someone has written meat in small letters next to Jockeys, and then beneath all of that, there is a gap. And then the names begin. There are more names under Jockeys than there are under Capel. I feel like asking the mountain of a man in front of me why that is. I wonder if Joseph knows. I also wonder if Gabe has gotten home. And I wonder, too, if Finn has managed to work out how a bucket works yet. Mostly, I can't think about any one thing for too long. And then I see him. A dark-haired boy who is made of all corners. He is standing next in line by the counter, silent and still in his blue-black jacket, his arms folded across his chest. He looks out of place and wild in here. Expression sharp, collar turned up against the back of his neck, hair still windblown from the beach. He is not looking at anyone, or away from anyone. He's just standing there, looking at the ground. His mind obviously far, far away from the butchers. Everyone else is being crowded and jostled, but no one crowds or jostles him. Though they don't seem to avoid him either. It's like he's just not in the same place as the rest of us.
Oh, Puck Connolly, says a voice behind me.
I turn and see an old man, not in line, just watching those of us who are. I think his name is Riley, or Thurber, or something. I recognize him as an old friend of my father's, one of those who's old enough that he had a name, but I never needed to know it. He's a dry, crinkly thing, with wrinkles in his face, deep enough for gulls to nest in.
What are you doing here on this night?
Meddling, I answer, because it's an answer that is difficult to argue with. I look back at the boy at the counter. He turns then, so he's in profile, and suddenly I think I know him from on the beach, the rider on the red stallion. Something about his expression and his wind-torn hair makes my heart go thump, thump, stop.
Puck Connolly, says the old man. Don't be looking at him like that.
Such a statement is too tantalizing to ignore. Who is he?
Lord, that's Sean Kendrick, the old man says,
and I lift my eyebrows as I half remember hearing the name. Like a bit of history you've been told a few times in school, but don't quite need to recall.
No one better than him for knowing the horses. He rides every year, and I reckon he's the one to beat. Always is. But he's got one foot on the land and one foot in the sea. You steer clear of him.
Of course I will, I say, though I don't know at the moment where I intend to steer. I look back to him, attaching the name. Sean Kendrick. He steps up to the counter then, and Peg smiles at him very brightly. Too brightly, I think. Like she's proving a point. I can't hear what she says, but I can't stop watching as he leans slightly toward her, uncrossing his arms to make some sort of small gesture with his fingers as he speaks. He has two fingers held up, and he presses them against the surface of the counter, tapping them twice, like he's counting. I can tell that he, for one, is not in love with Peg Grattan. I wonder if it's because he doesn't know that she could cut his heart out neat, or if he does know, and is just unimpressed with the knowing. Peg turns around with the chalk and stretches all the way up, and I see now that the space just underneath Jockeys was left there intentionally, because she doesn't hesitate as she writes Sean Kendrick at the very top of the list above everyone else. There are a few whoops from the crowd around me as she finishes writing his name. Sean Kendrick doesn't smile, but I see him nod to her. One of the other men pulls him aside to talk, and the line moves up. I'm one step closer to signing up. My guts do a small little dance inside me. Another step up. I'm wondering if it's nerves or the pressing heat of all these bodies that's making me lightheaded. Another step up. My stomach is an ocean of trouble as the man in front of me places a bet. And then it's me. Peg smiles at me like she smiles at everyone. She doesn't look scary at all. She looks plain and friendly. Hi, love. What do you need? You've picked quite a night to come out. I realize that she thinks I'm here for meat. I feel my cheeks warm and try to sound firm. I'm here to sign up, actually. Peg's smile remains in place, but it's like a picture of a smile someone has hung on her face instead. It is utterly motionless, and her eyes don't match it. Your brother told me not to let you sign up. He wanted me to find a rule against it. She means Gabe, of course. My stomach surges in a whole new way. I try not to sound frantic as I lean across the blood-stained counter. And right after that, I realize that she knew all along what I was here for, and still asked me the first question. Which I think means I need to change how I'm thinking of her. But I can't, because she still looks just plain and friendly. There's no rule, is there? There isn't any reason I can't. There's no rule, and I told him that for sure, but... Her smile is gone, and suddenly I can imagine her cutting out my heart in a hard, blank way that means she wouldn't even notice the blood. What would your parents think? Have you thought this through? People die, love. I'm all for women, but this isn't a woman's game. For some reason, this irritates me more than anything else I've heard all day. It's not even relevant. I give her the fierce look I practiced in the mirror. I've thought it through. I want to add my name, please. She looks at me a bit longer, and I don't let my face change. Then she sighs, picks up the chalk and turns to the board. She starts to write a P, and then rubs it out with the pad of her hand. She glances back at me. I can't remember your real first name, love. Kate, I say, and I feel like everyone in Skarmouth is suddenly staring at my back. Kate Connolly. There are moments that you'll remember for the rest of your life, and there are moments that you think you'll remember for the rest of your life. And it's not often they turn out to be the same moments. But when Peg Grattan turns around and chalks my name on the list, white on black, I know, without a doubt, that it's an image I'll never forget. When she turns back around, one of her eyebrows is raised. And your horse's name? Dove, I say. The word comes out too quiet. I have to repeat it. She writes it down, no questions asked. But of course, why would she doubt that Dove is a Kapil Ishka? I chew my lip. Peg is waiting. It's 50, Park, she says, to enter. I feel a little ill as I dig the coins out of my pocket. For a sickening moment, I don't think I have enough, but then I find the money I'd been carrying to buy flour. I hold it out, not releasing it into her waiting hand. Wait, I say. I lean across the counter, voice low. Are there, any rules about the horses? If I get disqualified and lose the 50, I really will be sick. About them, Peg says. You want a rule sheet? She has to look for it. I feel like everyone is staring at my name on the board while she does. When she offers it to me, a rumpled piece of paper, I scan the front and back. There are only two lines about the horses. Jockeys must declare their mount by the end of the first week at the Scorpio Festival Riders Parade. Swapping of mounts after that date is not permitted. I scan for anything at all, but there's nothing, nothing to say that I can't enter Dove. I finally let Peg have the coins. Thank you, I say. Do you want to keep that? Peg asks, gesturing to the rule sheet. I don't really care, but I nod. Okay, she says. You're official. I'm official. As I push outside into the dark, I take big breaths of the cold air. The briny smell of earlier has been mostly replaced by the faint scent of exhaust lingering in the air. But in comparison to the sweat and raw meat smell of the butcher, it's heavenly. My head feels all spinny and elated and terrified, and I feel like I can see every single little bump on the street in front of me, every bit of rust on the rail before the quay, every ripple in the water. Everything is black, the depthless sky and the inky water, and butter yellow, the street lamps and light pouring out from the shop windows. I realize that there is a discussion going on a few yards away, and I recognize Sean Kendrick's jacket. Mutt Mulvern faces him, looking massive and sweaty in comparison to Sean. It's clear from the way that a few people have paused nearby that what's being said is not pleasant. It's like birds worrying a crow. I've seen them in the fields, when the crow has gotten too close to their nest or otherwise insulted them. The other birds dive bomb and scream, and the crow merely stands there, looking dark and still and unimpressed. So it's just this. Sean and Mutt, heir to the island's fortune, and Mutt's spit glistening on Sean's boots.
"Nice boots," Mutt says.
He's looking down at them, but Sean Kendrick isn't. He watches Mutt's face with the same looking but not looking expression he had in the butcher's. I'm kind of horrified and fascinated by what I see on Mutt's face. It's not anger, but something like it. After a long moment, Sean turns as if to go.
"Hey,"
Mutt says. He has a smile on his face, but it means the opposite of a smile.
"Are you in such a hurry to get back to the stables? It's only been a few hours since you got on your fix."
He pumps his hips enthusiastically. I would have felt bad for Mutt's goading if I hadn't seen Sean's smile then. It's barely a wisp of a smile, only there for a second, not even really making his mouth move, just flattening his eyes a bit. And it's canny and condescending, and then it's gone. And I realize that what's on both their faces, in two entirely different shapes, is hatred.
"Say something, horse stroker," Mutt says. "Did you like my present to you?"
But his fists are clenched, and I don't think it's speaking he wants out of Sean Kendrick. And still Sean says nothing. He looks weary, if anything. And as Mutt shifts his feet to circle him, Sean simply begins to walk away.
"Don't walk away from me,"
Mutt snarls. He catches up to Sean in three uneven strides. And when he catches Sean's upper arm with his big hand, he spins Sean around as easily as a child.
"You work for me. You don't walk away from me."
Sean puts his hands in the pockets of his jacket.
"Indeed, Mr. Mulvern," he says, and his tone is so deadly calm that Dr. Horsell, who'd been watching, frowns and ducks back inside the butcher shop. "And what can I do for you this evening?"
This momentarily stumps Mutt Mulvern, and I think that he might just hit Sean Kendrick now and rustle up a good reply later. But then it comes to him and he says,
"I'm having my father let you go. For theft. Don't say it's not so. I had that horse, Kendrick, and you let him go. I'll have your job for that."
Money's not something many people have on this island. Talk of axing someone's job is not a thing to toss around lightly. It's not even my employment, and I already feel the pinch in my stomach, the same one I get when I open up the pantry door and see the shrinking contents.
"Will you now?" Sean says softly.
There's a long pause full of the sound of muffled voices in the butcher's.
"I saw you signed up for the races, but there's no horse there beside your name. Why is that, Mutt?"
Mutt's face purples.
"I think," Sean says, and as before, his voice is so quiet that all of us are holding our breath to hear him. "It's because, like every year, your father is waiting for me to pick a horse for you." "That's a lie," Mutt says. "You're no better than I am. My father lets you put me on the wasters. He lets you put me on the nags and the leftovers, and you take the best for yourself. I have no say in the matter, or I'd be on that red stallion. I'm not going to have you put me on a loser this year."
The door opens, and now Dr. Horsell has returned with Thomas Grattan. They stand in the doorway, and Thomas Grattan wipes his hands on his butcher's apron as he surveys the situation. Sean Kendrick's low voice has somehow made the argument both quieter and more impressive, a silent night ocean full of restrained power. The space between Sean Kendrick and Mutt Mulvern seems charged.
Boys,
Thomas Fretton says, and though he sounds jovial, I can see